Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. What sort of chemical contaminants are in your body right now, and what long-term effect might they have on your health? For those of us who try to care for our bodies by eating right, exercising, and accessing preventive care, the number of toxic substances that can be found in the body of the average man, woman, and child in America are sobering, to say the least. Even newborn babies' bodies are found to contain chemical contaminants, but passed into their fragile systems by their mothers while they're still in the womb. My guest today was inspired to investigate how it happens and what we might do to protect ourselves after receiving an unexpected cancer diagnosis a few years ago and wanting to know why he had developed what could have been a life-threatening illness. McKay Jenkins is Cornelius A. Tillman Professor of English and Director of Journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. McKay, welcome to THINK.
Thank you very much for having me.
So when you found out you had cancer, first of all, you had no idea the diagnosis was coming. And to the same extent you worried about your health, you wanted to know why this had happened to you. Can you talk about that?
I'd be happy to. I should make it clear at first, though, that let me tell you how the story unfolded. I went to see a doctor with what I thought was a running injury. I had some pain in my left leg between my hip and my knee. And my internist recommended that I see an orthopedist, which I did, and it was no trouble, and he was not concerned about it. He said, you know, this is not an uncommon thing, and what we ought to do just to be on the safe side is have a quick MRI. So he put me through an MRI machine, and that seemed fairly fine, and there were no red flags. And then late in the afternoon on a Friday, I think it was, I got a phone call at home that said, this is your orthopedist calling. You need to call an oncologist because we found a suspicious mass in your abdomen. And the thing that stuck with me, both at that moment and really ever since, was that my kids at the time were about a year and a half old and about five. So I had very young kids, and I was, you know, trying to navigate this diagnosis with trying to prevent this information from reaching the ears of my children.
Yeah.
You know, this is a difficult thing for anyone. Now, what happened is the next month, my wife and I spent running around trying to figure out what this thing was, how best to deal with it, and all those sorts of things that you would do if you got this kind of scary information. We ended up going to a hospital center, and I was just in my surgical scrubs ready to go in for surgery when a couple of public health researchers came up to me. I was in my surgical scrubs ready, I mean, literally minutes from going under the knife, and they said, do you mind if we ask you a few questions? And I thought, you know, what more can I possibly say? I've already given my medical history to all these different doctors, and they said, we're curious to ask you about your chemical exposure over your lifetime. And I said, what do you mean by that? What kinds of chemicals? And they started to run down what turned out to be a very lengthy list of chemicals. I mean, many, many dozens of chemicals and products that contain chemicals and all this. They asked me about my employment history, where I'd lived, what kinds of things that I might have done in my house, in my job, what kinds of things I might have come into contact with.
And they asked if you dry cleaned your clothes. I mean,
yeah, I mean, everything from dry cleaning chemicals to formaldehyde. They said, did you know about construction materials and what they're made of? And I mean, all these things. I mean, there are some products that I knew. I mean, I sort of had this vague sense that construction. I'd done some rehabilitation work on my house, and you know, new construction materials were often full of stuff. But I really didn't have a whole lot of ideas about what these things were made out of. Anyway, the way the story unfolded is they said thank you very much and left, and I went into surgery, and they yanked this tumor out of me, and lo and behold, it was benign. So after having lived for a month with this fear that I had what they call a soft tissue sarcoma, which is not something you want in your abdomen, they pulled this thing out, and on the operating table, they did a quick cell scan on it, and then later on, about a week later, they finalized this and found out it was benign after all. So I asked the doctor, I said, how often does that happen? He said, well, we see about 100 of these, and four are benign, the rest are malignant, so you really are a lucky man. And I did feel lucky. I mean, I had felt terrified for a month, and now I felt extremely fortunate, but I was left with a great number of questions, as anybody would, with where this thing had come from. Were there any things that I could have done to prevent having to go through this? And I started thinking back on all these questions that I'd been asked in the hospital, and that led me to do all this research, which turned into this book.
One thing that really comes through here is that even those of us who try to live clean are constantly exposed to toxins. Talk about, I think it was in Maine, this study that looked at people from a variety of walks of life, including a few who were certain they would be sort of pure and free of any toxins.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good question. And this is one of the first things that I thought about. I said, if I've been exposed to all this stuff, then everyone must have been exposed to this stuff, because I'd never worked in a plant. I'd basically had two careers in my life. I'd been a journalist and I'd been a professor. And in other words, I'd not worked in a petrochemical plant. I'd never fabricated, construction materials or made formaldehyde in a laboratory. I was about as white collar as they come. And I started to say, it occurred to me at some point early in this process that maybe I should go get what they call a body burden test. Now, this is something that anyone can do, but the trouble is you need a lot of money to do it, because at this stage these are fairly pricey. You can offer samples of your blood, your hair, your urine to a certain couple of laboratories, and they can spin this stuff through and tell you what you have in your body. Now, they will say things like, you have arsenic in your body, or you have formaldehyde in your body, or you have plasticizing chemicals or flame retardants in your body. They can find that, and I can fairly well promise most of your listeners that most of them would have some level of contamination from this stuff. That is, they're just walking around with it. Now, these studies will not then say that because you have flame retardants, you therefore will develop breast cancer. They don't. The accuracy of the science has not reached that level yet. But what these body burden studies are designed to do is simply document the fact that these chemicals are in our bodies. Now, if you think about it, this book goes into quite a bit of detail about sort of the way that our culture has been sort of saturated with these chemicals over the last, say, 60 or 70 years. Most of it is traced back to World War II, and we can talk about that in a minute. But in the past, if you think about Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring, for example, in the early 1960s, what she was trying to wake people up to was the fact that people were spraying agricultural pesticides over every square inch of land, and that had consequences, that you don't just get to kill, bugs here or weeds there, that these chemicals stay around. They go downstream, they recycle, they end up in our drinking water, they end up in fish, they end up in our food, all that sort of thing. What these body burden studies are designed to do is to even shrink that gap of abstraction even more. Like, what they're trying to say is you use chemicals in point A, and a person living in point B is going to have these chemicals in their body, not just sort of out there in the environment somewhere, but in their body. And the idea is that if you can convince people to wake up to the fact that these synthetic chemicals, in fact, do not disappear, they don't just show up in your lake or in your fish, they show up in your breast tissue, for example, or you can find them in your hair follicles, they can find them in your blood, then maybe people will start to get the notion that these synthetic chemicals, which we are literally saturated with, the volume of these chemicals that are produced is absolutely staggering, that people will suddenly realize that there is no, you don't just get to flush this stuff away. There's no away place that this stuff goes to. It just sticks around and it ends up back into our bodies. And that can be a powerful message for people to understand.
McKay, why was there such a synthetic revolution following World War II?
Well, that's a good question, and some of your readers may know the work of Michael Pollan, who's written a lot about the industrial food system, and he has a line, I think, in The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he says something like, the entire industrial food system is floating on an ocean of oil. And what he means by that is, after World War II, when we developed all of these various chemical compounds, some of them for industrial purposes, some of them for the war effort, they discovered, among other things, how to effectively create synthetic fertilizers. So you can make fertilizers that are no longer based on, the old stuff like manure. Now they could synthesize it. And so you have an enormously effective way of fertilizing croplands. And therefore, a lot of the food that we eat is growing in soil that is now saturated with synthetic chemicals. That we sort of understood that. Like, the food question has gotten a fair bit of attention in the last 10 years or so. But what really is that this project is intended to show is that these same chemicals, many, many hundreds and thousands of chemicals that have been developed in the last 50 or 60 years, are also used to make everything else that we have. So if you just look around your room, for example, look around your office, look around your house, try to pick out the things that you are looking at that are made out of things that are not, wood or wool or cotton. Look at all of the synthetic fabrics, all the synthetic plastics, all the synthetic ingredients. ingredients that go into your shampoo and your cosmetics and your mattress and your pillows and your upholstery and your drapes and your shower curtain, everything is made out of some sort of synthetic compound. And in this book, one of the I came across so many sort of amusing little anecdotes that I threw into this book and intended to sort of take the edge off some of these sort of scarier scientific realities. And one thing I found was that when the Titanic went down in 1912, mm-hmm. and when they brought it, when they discovered it again, and they started to bring all this stuff that had been on that boat up to the surface, they were finding things like jewelry and cutlery and chandeliers and all kinds of things. But one of the archaeologists who was looking through all this stuff, he said the amazing thing about this boat, which was the most luxurious thing that had ever been created in 1912, had no plastic on it. Hmm. I mean, the most luxurious ship ever created, there was no synthetic stuff on it in 1912. And 30 years later, you know, we're in the middle of World War II, and suddenly there's this huge, you know, second sort of industrial revolution going on, and suddenly we just became, again, saturated with this stuff because industry was coming up with all these new ways to make stuff. And that has affected everything that we buy. Our entire consumer culture is just like our food system is built on an ocean of petrochemicals and synthetics.
You write here that before you started to think about this seriously and investigate this as a journalist, that you had sort of taken for granted much of your life that chemicals that were available for consumer use must have been tested somewhere by someone so that they were permitted to be on the shelves of our stores and sprayed on our couches and on our mattresses. But in fact, that's often not the case.
Well, it's actually quite the opposite. And, you know, people ask me, they said, so you spent 2 or 3 years researching this book. Are you terrified? Are you even more neurotic now than you were before? Whatever they say. And I said, you know, honestly, the deepest feeling that I got after this project was not that. It was not anxiety. It was not fear. Because actually, again, like with the food question, once you have access to information, you can make a lot of very empowering choices. Like you can look at an array of possible purchases and you can choose one that is in fact better for you. Like information serves you well, and this book has lots and lots of recommendations for that sort of thing. But the overarching kind of reaction I had to all this work was just how broken the regulatory system is when it comes to this stuff. So what you have, again, just to flash back to 1962 when Silent Spring came out. Now, when Rachel Carson wrote that book, it came out in The New Yorker and then it came out in book form, and it became one of the most influential books of the 20th century. I mean, people were completely shocked by this, and they were reading her chronicle of all these chemicals, and they started to demand that change, that somebody start paying attention to what is being sprayed everywhere. Well, it took almost 15 years to get the EPA up and running to the point that they could regulate some of these herbicides and pesticides. Now, what they passed something called the Toxic Substances Control Act, known as TSCA, in the mid-1970s, and this was a law that Congress passed to try to get some kind of handle on all these chemicals. Now, unfortunately, what they did is they grandfathered in all the chemicals that had already been invented. So you had something like 62,000 chemicals that were in use, in common industrial use, which were, you know, exempted from having to be tested for health consequences. And since then, since the 1970s, you've invented another 20,000 more different chemicals that are used to make things. And what we have now, I mean, the general numbers that you'll hear are that we have something like 80,000 chemicals that are in common industrial use. And out of 80,000 synthetic chemicals that are being used to make everything, again, from your carpeting to your toothbrush, 200 have ever been tested for any, really seriously tested for any kind of health consequence. That's 200 out of 80,000. Hmm. And out of 80,000, only 5 have ever been banned outright for their health problems. Now, we can talk about this later, I suppose, but this model is familiar to Americans. Like we think that less regulation is better, but what you find is that less regulation in this case actually has consequences. Like you don't regulate stuff, people are full of toxic chemicals. That's one leads to the next.
My guest is McKay Jenkins, professor of English and director of journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. Join us now at 1-800-933-5372 or at think@kera.org.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is McKay Jenkins. He's professor of English and director of journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. People are really interested in the specifics of the book and what you found and what we can replace regular consumer goods with that might be a little bit safer. But I do want to talk about this because I just found this astonishing. You write in the very beginning of the book about how PCBs were tested for safety. Do you remember that specific example? And if you do, would you talk about it?
This is where they put a bunch of PCBs in a bucket and stuck some fish in there.
Yeah,
and a couple of days later, if the fish were still alive, then PCBs were fine.
Yeah, it was only half the fish, according to the book. They had to still be alive.
If were alive, then that would be fine. Well, and the reason I threw that in there is because it gives you some sort of anecdotal evidence of how shabby the regulatory mindset has been. You have other stories about, say, I forget if it was DDT or another pesticide that a scientist said, I'm going to take a teaspoon of this every day for a while, and if it doesn't kill me, then it's fine. And people said, well, that sounds reasonable enough, and he lived, and, this is not science. This is not the way you want to base. I mean, when you start extrapolating out and talking about how many millions of pounds of this stuff are being used every year, you want to have, like, really strong evidence that the stuff is safe. And I should mention, also, we talked about this a little bit before the break, but in this country, we have this sense that when we're talking about chemicals, that chemicals are, as they say, innocent until proven guilty. So, for example, if there is someone somewhere that can prove that they got cancer because of their exposure to a very specific chemical in a very specific circumstance, then maybe somehow through, a lot of litigation, they might get some relief. They might get, an award of some kind. And maybe if they're even luckier that some legislation will get passed. But that is virtually impossible to do, as you know. It's almost impossible to say that, my breast cancer was caused by sleeping on that mattress back in 1982. That doesn't happen. The thing is that in Europe, over the last 10 years or so, things have really changed dramatically, where in Europe they say chemicals are guilty until proven innocent. So when you want to introduce a new compound, you have to do extensive health testing in advance of releasing these chemicals onto the market to prove that they won't cause problems. And that, just to give you one number off the top of my head, there's something like 400 chemicals in cosmetics that are illegal to use in Europe but are legal to use in the United States. And you will have some very surreal circumstances where you have a single company, a single factory that is making a similar product, one version of it for the European market and one version for the American market, and the American market can be full of stuff that is not even legal to use in Europe because in America the regulatory system allows it to come on in. And I think people, this goes back to this again, this appetite that you have for regulation. If you have no appetite for regulation, then what you get is stuff that is, like, demonstrably bad for you. If you have some regulation, some common sense regulation, you can prevent that. And this, one of the background ideas in this book is that, they're cancer scientists, they will say that the war on cancer has been lost despite the billions and billions that have been thrown at it. We're still getting, enormous numbers in cancer. And one thing we should be doing is spending more time, energy, and attention to preventing this stuff in the first place. Once the horse is out of the barn, it's really hard to cope with it. And so there's a whole preventive sensibility to this book, which is to look at stuff that's out there and figure out how we can get it out of our lives and maybe do ourselves a good turn in the long run.
All right, so let's talk about some of the places that we are commonly exposed to toxins in everyday life. I guess we'll start in the house. Just the things we, not just clean our bodies with, but the things we wipe off the counter with. There's all kinds of things that we end up in our systems with, even though they're meant for external use.
Well, sure. I mean, there are a number of things we could talk about. And some of these, again, this book is as much about culture as it is about science. So it's funny to sometimes take a particular substance and not just think about it scientifically or chemically, but think about it culturally. So if I said to you, for example, how do you feel about chlorine? you might say, well, chlorine, that stuff keeps us clean, and it's great for the floors, and it's, you know, it's in the swimming pools. And I always have these sort of associations with summertime and swimming in a pool and having that chlorine smell in my hair, and maybe you have kind of nostalgic, warm feelings about that. Well, chlorine was also used as a chemical weapon, and chlorine is not by any stretch a neutral compound. Like, you would, if you had a choice, you would rather not have chlorine in your body or on your body. But we are absolutely marinating in chlorine, for example. So even people, let me just take a step sideways here, for example. There's a chapter in the book that is called The Tap, and it's all about the various contaminants that get into drinking water. Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, I take a canoe ride down the Brandywine River up in Wilmington, Delaware, which is the source of drinking water for all of the northern part of the state and the city of Wilmington. Now, the Brandywine is contaminated, as all urban rivers are, by all kinds of things like farm runoff, and, you know, so all the herbicides and the fertilizers and stuff that are running off of the chicken farms or the mushroom farms in Delaware or Pennsylvania. It's also contaminated by everything that's running off the pavement everywhere. I mean, all the shopping mall parking lots, all the streets, all that stuff ends up in the river. It's also contaminated, as the book points out, and some of your listeners may have heard about this, they have done studies of municipal drinking water supplies around the country, and they find demonstrable amounts of pharmaceutical drugs in everybody's water. So you can pull a glass of tap water in L.A., for example, and you can find Viagra in it. You can find antipsychotics in your water in Philadelphia. You can find, you know, erection drugs in your water in Baltimore. I mean, in every water supply you check, you will find pharmaceuticals. Why is that? Because pharmaceuticals are not all absorbed and metabolized by your body. So you think about the size of the pharmaceutical industry and how much of this stuff is getting, in fact, peed out into the drinking water system, and you have another big source of contamination. All this, I promise, is coming back to chlorine. So it turns out that municipal water treatment plants, you know, every city has them. They were built, you know, 150 years ago to kill stuff like cholera,
yeah.
Kill stuff like dysentery. Well, you can't kill Viagra, and you can't kill, you know, oil that is running off of a parking lot. Putting all the chlorine in the world is not going to solve that problem. So there are people who are professional drinking water people who are trying to figure out not only how can we deal with these synthetic chemicals, which you can't kill, but how can we move past the chlorine? I mean, we're not so much worried about cholera anymore. How can we stop putting these chemicals into the drinking water? So, you know, even at a level that we're very comfortable with, something like chlorine in our drinking water, that is not necessarily considered a universal positive.
But you still say tap water is, by and large, better for us than buying bottled water.
Well, that's one of these conundrums, because people say, well, gosh, I don't trust getting Viagra out of my tap. What do I do? Maybe I'll buy bottled water. The problem there, not to sound like Cassandra here, but, you know, at least the water that's coming out of your tap is, in fact, regulated. Like, every city has to have inspectors checking the water. And now, it may not be perfect, but it actually is on the whole, really good. For example, I grew up in New York. New York City, you might think New York City couldn't possibly have clean water. It has some of the cleanest water of any city in the United States, because it all comes from these really beautifully maintained reservoirs up in the Catskills and north of the city. So they've kept the forests around these bodies of water, and the water is really excellent in New York. The trouble in the bottled water situation is that you not only have the contaminants in the water, but it is not regulated. Bottled water is regulated as a food, not as water, which may strike you as counterintuitive, but believe me, it's not the only counterintuitive thing here. You also have the problem of the water being contaminated by the bottle that it's in. So you have, for example, the drinking water that's in plastic those soft, crinkly plastic bottles are made with stuff called phthalates, which are these endocrine-disrupting plasticizers in that. If you drink out of an old Nalgene bottle, which we all used to do, old Nalgene bottles used to be made with bisphenol A, which is a hard plastic. And you can demonstrate, in a laboratory, you can check out how much of this stuff is leaking into the water. And if you do things like heat up, this is something that especially a lot of your mothers will recognize, that these same BPA, bisphenol A compounds, were used to make plastic baby bottles. And all of us use these things unthinkingly. As I said, we have two kids, and so you'd wake up at 3 in the morning, you go down and warm up a bottle of milk, breast milk, on your stovetop, and turn the burner on and warm that thing up. Well, as you warm up the liquid, the plastic is actually leaking into the breast milk even faster than if it was at room temperature. And then you're taking that bottle of milk, which is now contaminated with a hormone-disrupting plastic, and you're sticking it right in your kid's mouth. And mothers especially this is something we should definitely talk about later, but mothers, women generally and mothers specifically, have a huge amount of moral force when it comes to this question of toxic chemicals, because when they decide that they don't want bisphenol A in their baby bottles, they as a group make a move and the industry changes. And now you find in state after state, they're banning this stuff. And in market after market after market, they're removing it. So now you find BPA-free Nalgene bottles, BPA-free baby bottles. It's women that hold the key to this, and it's a very energizing time to be an educated woman when it comes to regulating some of these chemicals.
And I don't want to get stuck for too long on baby bottles, but the clear nipples are better than the ones that are sort of tinted, kind of that amber color?
I think that's right. I mean, the whole question of dyes is a whole other thing to concern yourself with. But generally, you know, the rule of thumb, and we can talk about this later, but the end of the book is full of these kind of generic boilerplate statements. And one thing you might think about is trying to use something like a glass bottle instead of a plastic bottle, and then you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. So, yeah, I think it's really worth thinking about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Brian in Fort Worth. Hi, Brian.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I'm all for knowledge and all for regulation and all for everything that the author says. And early on, the very first sentence or two, it was mentioned that, you know, if you get one of these analyses done of your body or if you're concerned about all these chemicals in your body, it does not mean that they are harmful. But then the rest of the conversation is talked about all the potential harm they might do, like the nipples, should we get this color or that color? And it's, well, yeah, you probably should. And it's just, I just want to make the point to people that not to overdo it and not demonize, you know, all of these chemicals and polyvinyls in our system until we know more. Knowledge is wonderful. Let's keep going. But let's be careful and not over-demonizing them and almost like DDT. It was felt to be so terribly harmful. And because of that, millions of people in Africa died from mosquitoes. And now DDT in the amount that they used for sprays probably isn't harmful. So just a cautionary warning. That's all I have to say. But otherwise, I agree with everything that's being said. Thank you.
Thanks.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah, please do.
I think he makes some really excellent points, and I'm glad he called. Because, you know, freaking out and getting overly worried is not going to do anybody any good. And there are cases, like when he mentions DDT, that's actually one of the most interesting and complicating questions because, again, to keep going back to Rachel Carson, who started this whole conversation all these years ago, you know, you invent these chemicals, they can kill bugs, so everyone goes crazy and they kill all the bugs. Well, now all the bugs are dead and you start to have, like, for example, where we live in the Mid-Atlantic, you have population crashes in birds because birds have nothing left to eat because all the bugs have been destroyed. So you have that. That's the Rachel Carson question. The problem with DDT is that, and I have a number of friends who work in international relief, and they say the thing about DDT is it really works at killing mosquitoes. And if you have 10 million people a year who are being killed by malaria, and you can get rid of malaria-carrying mosquitoes by spraying DDT, then what would you rather have, people dying of malaria or people maybe someday contracting a problem with DDT? And they said, what do you think about that? And I said, well, I don't really know what to say, except that there ought to be a way to invent a chemical compound that is not as dangerous to people as DDT, but it can still take care of mosquitoes. So there's a question. Like when we talk about regulation being antithetical to business, a lot of what I'm talking about is actually opening up huge opportunities for business to create alternative ideas, alternative products. So creating, for example, an insecticide that is less harmful to people but is effective at killing malaria-carrying mosquitoes would be a huge opportunity for a business to come up with. So he makes a lot of very, very good points about that.
Another thing that, you know, is so it's a big deal these days that everything has, you know, antibacterial properties, and we want to buy these cleansers at home that will kill germs. And it may be that the bacteria they're killing pose fewer harms in the long term than some of the long term effects of the chemicals themselves. Can you talk just in general about the cleaning products we use, just, you know, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, things like that?
Yeah, and you know, this is funny. I remember reading a piece somewhere along the line that was written by a woman talking about the way her grandmother kept house and the way contemporary people keep house. She said, you know, if my grandmother had any idea of how obsessed we are with keeping like a clean room. You know what a clean room is, where they make computer chips and stuff? Like, people think that their bathrooms and their kitchens have to be bacteria free, which, you know, in a scientific, or whatever you would say, a chemical sense, is a crazy standard to have.
Like, yeah.
you, You, in fact, do not have to live in a bacteria-free place. What you have to live is in a place that is in balance somehow. And the trouble, as you mentioned with the antibiotics, is if you become so obsessed with this idea of sterility, this actually, by the way, brings up the lawn question, for example. Like if your idea of a perfect lawn is one that is absolutely devoid of any life except a single species of grass, you are setting an unrealistic and an unsustainable and an unhealthy standard for yourself.
Well, then I can boast about myself there.
Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, this just to, I'm trying to, if I can, extrapolate your question true for a variety of things. Like, if you have standards of sterility, standards of cleanliness, one question to ask is the scientific question, how can I achieve that? But another question is a cultural question, which is, what makes me want that? What makes me want to have a sterile, I'm not talking about a dirty, I'm talking about what, I mean, I'm not talking about a clean kitchen, I'm talking about a sterile kitchen or a sterile bathroom or a sterile lawn. What is it that makes me want that? And that is a cultural question. That's not just a scientific question. And then you start to think about, gets into all this stuff, like the history of the domestic place or the history of the lawn and the landscape. Like, where did we get our ideas that led us to this? Now, one thing, if I can, this is why the book has a lot to say about things like advertising, for example. If you look at, just to take the lawn, for example, if you look at the lawn, you know, you think about post-war housing developments. Up here in the Northeast, we have all these Levittown developments where they came in after the war, and they built tens of thousands of houses all at once. Everybody moved into them. And then they started to create this sort of suburban mindset, which is that your house needs to look exactly like your neighbor's house, not just your house, but your lawn. And so you can imagine what kind of an industrial opportunity this was. So these chemical companies, these lawn care companies came in and said, we can make your lawn look perfectly exactly like your neighbor's. In fact, they can make it look exactly like the Masters golf tournament. Have you seen that tournament on TV? We can make your lawn look just like that. We'll sell you this herbicide that'll kill all the clover in your lawn. And you say, great, I don't want clover because clover doesn't look like my neighbor. My neighbor has no clover, so I'll buy this product. You spray all this stuff on your lawn. It kills all the clover. Then you discover that clover is a nitrogen fixer, and it pulls nitrogen out of the water and fixes it into your soil. Now you need to buy nitrogen. You need to buy synthetic nitrogen from the same chemical company. So now instead of selling you zero products, which you don't need, he's selling you two products, which you do need, just to keep up with the Joneses. And you see this entire industry grows up on this weird aesthetic notion that you have to look exactly like your neighbor.
McGay Jenkins is my guest. He's professor of English and director of journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is McKay Jenkins. He's professor of English and director of journalism at the University of Delaware and author of the new book, What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. McKay, the culture question is really interesting here. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and I remember, you know, TV commercials aimed at people of my mom's generation essentially were out to make mothers feel guilty if they hadn't, you know, gotten their towels as clean as the neighbors. And these days, you know, the form it takes now for our generation raising kids is if you really care about your kids, you will give them this sterile environment. You know, they shouldn't touch a toy that's not treated with antibacterial medications.
Yeah. No, I think this is what I said earlier about that. What you've just said is the most lasting impression that I got from all this research. I mean, the science and the chemicals and all that is one thing that this book is about. But that question about why we behave the way we do and how that has come to be, that is the more interesting thing. Because once you examine your behavior and look at it objectively, you can then be empowered to make different kinds of choices. So, if, for example, someone is saying into your ear, if you're living in Levittown, you need to have your lawn this way. You can either do that automatically, or you can step back and ask, who's telling me this? What information are they giving to me, and where do they get their information, and what's their What's their purpose in telling me this? If you're a mother and someone is saying, you need to sterilize your bathroom and sterilize your kitchen, and by the way, sterilize your food, you might ask yourself, where's that information coming from, and is it reliable, and how do I know? And what you find, I mean, not to sound too cynical about this, but what you find is that there is a great deal of money to be made by making people afraid. And if you can, I mean, here's another thing. I keep coming back to clover. I, for some reason, became obsessed with clover when I was doing this research. So clover becomes something that you can kill, but how do you convince somebody that clover is bad? Well, what they came up with this idea is to say, are your children being stung by bees? If your children are being stung by bees, there may be a reason for that. It's because the bees are attracted to the clover. Now, if we can kill the clover, your kids will happily play kickball in their backyard and never get stung by bees. Now, their objective was to sell you an herbicide that could kill clover, not to save your kids from getting stung by bees, but by creating this fear that suddenly you were having this magnet for bees was very effective. Same thing here. Are you worried that your children are going to get sick? Well, of course we are. Everyone's worried about their kids getting sick. The answer is not to kill every last bacteria. I have friends who grew up in India, and they say in India, there's not this obsession with killing bacteria. And you know what's weird in India is that kids don't have some of these crazy allergies that we have. They don't have this crazy asthma. I mean, there are all kinds of things that growing up in a place that is actually slightly less clean is actually enormously beneficial to your general immune system. So this idea that you sell fear and you get people to overreact by killing every last thing, whether it's an insect like a mosquito or a bee or it's a bacteria or whatever it is, has no kind of, it's not a sustainable, it's not a balanced approach to things. So having a more balanced idea about what in fact is dangerous, what in fact is not dangerous, gives you a chance to make wiser decisions out there and listen to your own common sense. I mean, a lot of what we've given up in the last 50 years is any kind of common sense. We don't have to take our cues on what to eat or what to clean our house with from a company. We can actually decide for ourselves. It's not that complicated. You know, people were eating and cleaning their homes for a lot of years before any company came in and said, you need to spray this. You know, one of the chapters in the book is my wife and I take what I called a natural history tour through a big box store, a big box department store, and just went aisle by aisle by aisle looking at all this stuff. And among the things we found, for example, were, you know, products made with things that were on the product. It was labeled, this is a carcinogen in the product that would show up in the hardware section. Then you go into the cosmetic section, and there would be a product that does not have a label on it, but is made with the same carcinogenic ingredient, but the product doesn't have to be labeled because cosmetics don't have to be labeled. So you have that bizarre thing. Now, that defies common sense. But there's this other thing, and this is intended to kind of offer a little humor or comic relief for this chapter, but if you walk into a big box store, just use your nose the next time you're in there and see what you can smell. And let me just back up. Another chapter has this toxicologist walking through my house and like walking through and pointing all this stuff. He said, you know, the best thing you can do to convince somebody that their house is full of synthetic chemicals is to ask them to take every aerosol can in their house, every can of paint, every can of laundry detergent and floor wax and everything they've got, and put it in a big plastic bag and tie it up. And then at the end of a month, open that thing up and stick your face in it and see what you smell. And everything you smell is like a neurotoxin. There are all kinds of things going on there. He said, now imagine if you could take a big bag and wrap it around a Walmart. You know, imagine what that would smell like after a month. You know, and so when you walk into a big box store, try walking aisle by aisle by aisle and seeing what your nose tells you. And the thing that I was sort of joking about in this chapter was the so-called lavender smell, which was like coming from every corner of this store. It was coming from the fake potpourri and the fake air freshener and the fake laundry detergent. All this stuff was made with this sort of fake scent, which is not, I mean, it's made with stuff that you just don't want in your body. And then you start to see how ubiquitous this is. Like, try to go into a public restroom now, and they've got these motion sensor air fresheners, and I wish I could put quotes around the word freshener, but we're on the radio, so I'll have to do the fake, you know, the thing with my fingers. The air fresheners to make it smell like lavender or make it smell like apple pie or something. And when we were looking through the store, my wife said, you know, it used to be that if you wanted your house to smell like an apple pie, you would make an apple pie.
Yeah, God forbid, right?
You know? And so now what we want is we want the smell, but we don't want to actually have to work to do it. So what we do is we spray it out of a can because some company said, don't you wish your house smelled like your grandmother's house or something? So now we spray it. We don't bake it. You know, so like one of the recommendations here is like, you know, live like your grandmother did. If you want your house to smell fresh, open your window. Don't buy something, just open your window. You know, you don't have to be a slave to the marketing is what I'm saying.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak this time with Lolly and Tyler. Hey, Lolly.
Oh, hi. I was going to ask if you knew how harmful lipstick is. But is it really, do we know that air freshener, smelling air fresheners is really harmful, or is it just that we don't really know how harmful it is?
Well, let me, thank you. Those are good questions, and let me see if I can answer. I'm gonna give your listeners a website to look at that will help with all the cosmetics and personal care products. There's a place called safecosmetics.org, and they've got a very good database there that will allow people to plug their products, the products that they like, they have, or that they routinely buy, plug the product in, and this database will tell you what it's made of, and it'll tell you what those ingredients, what kinds of worries those ingredients might have. So that's a great, great research place to go. There's the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics is another place. So safecosmetics.org and the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, those are two great places to look for any questions about what goes into personal care products. The question about air fresheners, now, this may sound strange, but I mentioned this compound earlier called phthalates. Now, phthalates is actually a really hard word to spell. It's P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S, phthalates. And those compounds are everywhere in all kinds of products, most famously in things like soft drinking bottles, but also in things like soft rubber toys, like rubber duckies and things like that. But they also go into things like, you know, books that your kid can read in the bathtub, you know, anything that's made with like a soft plastic frequently have phthalates. And phthalates are known to be what they call endocrine disruptors, meaning they can get in there and mess around with your hormones. Now, what's weird about it is that phthalates can also be found in air fresheners. And as I understand it, it's because the plasticizing compound is used to basically as a vehicle to transmit the scent. Whatever the odor is has to be attached to something chemically, and what they attach it to is these plasticizing phthalates. So when you breathe in a big lung full of air freshener, there's a decent chance that this product has been made with these phthalates, which are the same compounds that people are banning from all these baby products because they contain these endocrine-disrupting compounds. So who would have thought that you'd find plastic in air fresheners? But, you know, again, when you're talking about chemistry, you can do a lot of things with a lot of different compounds, and there you have it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's actually, we have an email here from Eric in Dallas. What about the antibacterial properties of silver and copper as used in drinks and coating hospital beddings and walls, etc.? And what about the creation of superbugs that these elements will no longer kill?
You know what? I actually don't know a thing about silver and copper in those contexts. The question about superbugs is a very, very legitimate and frightening one that has gotten a fair bit of attention. And this goes back to your earlier question about antibacterial soaps, for example, but also, of course, famously and most troublingly in the industrial food system, when you're inoculating beef cattle, for example, or you're inoculating chicken feed, or whatever you're doing with these antibacterials to kill bugs that kill these massive numbers of animals that we're slaughtering, what happens, of course, is that the bacteria, as a rapidly evolving organism, may and does, you know, evolve into a being that can survive any kind of antibacterial attack. So the worry is that if you start to, this goes back to the question about why you want to sanitize everything. If you obsess about sanitizing everything, killing all bacteria, what you're going to do is kill this generation of bacteria, but the next generation or the one after that is going to evolve a defense against that. And what the worry is that you're eventually going to create these bacteria that are resistant to any kind of antibacterial. So the worry would be that, you know, there might be an outbreak of some kind of bacterial disease that we can't cure because we don't have any more antibacterials that will work. So the idea, again, is to get comfortable living with a few bugs around so that you have defenses against them and not worrying about like dropping the nuclear bomb every single time you come into contact with something. The question is, like, can you have a sense of the big picture, not just the micro picture of killing everything you have right around you? Because, like I said at the beginning, nothing goes away. It all stays in the system. It ends up in your body. It ends up in the environment. We need to reduce the total volume of this stuff.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Barbara in Dallas. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I had a question for the author regarding
the impact of his environment, specifically being located in Delaware and surrounded by petrochemical companies and DuPont and ICI and Hercules and all the historic, all the companies that are around him, what impact that actually had on his body scan or whatever it was he had.
You know, I'm so glad you know about that in Dallas. It's actually worse than you, not in a chemical sense, but in a cultural sense. So I teach at the University of Delaware. The name DuPont is on virtually every classroom building on this campus.
Better living through chemistry.
Exactly. So, I mean, the chapter in this book on lawn chemicals actually opens with a little story about how one day I was teaching a class outdoors on the grass, as you know you do occasionally, and we're sitting there, and by pure coincidence, we were talking about toxic chemicals that day and lawn chemicals and things. And as literally, I mean, I swear I didn't plan this, but as we're sitting there, a groundskeeper came by with his little rider mower, but he wasn't mowing. He was spraying out of like six different nozzles up and back, right where we were sitting. And I said to my students, I said, who's going to go ask this guy what he's using? And somebody went up, and the guy said, oh, it's called 2,4-D. Don't worry about it. Where you guys are sitting, we sprayed that 5 hours ago. And that was supposed to make us feel better, you know. But meanwhile, we're sitting literally in the shadow of the DuPont building on one side and the shadow of the Gore, as in Gore-Tex, building on the other side. And, you know, you wonder, like, so what does the name DuPont mean to one of my students? The name DuPont means jobs. It means classroom buildings. It means, you know, endowed professorships that have the name DuPont. I mean, the name DuPont is gold around here. And so there are very few people that would be willing to even ask the question. And, you know, you find out that DuPont makes, for example, Teflon, which, you know, the nonstick cookware. And that, I mean, I'll just give you one example. Teflon gets a lot of press occasionally when, this is a really strange story, but it turns out that tropical birds are incredibly sensitive to the Teflon chemicals. And you'll pick up the paper one day, and there'll be a story about a woman who was frying an egg on her stovetop, and the phone rang, and she went to answer the phone, and she forgot about the egg. And now not only is the egg burnt to a crisp, but the Teflon in her pan is actually breaking down, and it's aerosolizing, right? It's entering the air, and her parakeet is dead. And I've read that story in a number of different places, and people say, well, how did that bird die? Was he, you know, was it the egg? And the answer is no. It was the aerosolized Teflon chemicals. And you find out that the plant that makes Teflon was fined like $100 million for contaminating drinking water, but it was in West Virginia, and nobody cares about West Virginia because it's off the map, you know. But people in Delaware, when they think about DuPont, they think about this fantastic company, but they don't hear the news about West Virginia. Do you know? So this is, again, a cultural question. Like, there's a lot going on here, is what I want to say.
Just have to be, I guess, careful and try to know what you're putting in your environment.
Yeah, and so whatever happened to, a steel pan with olive oil in it? You know, like, who told you that you need to have the nonstick coating built into the pan? And why would you want, like, what do you think you're getting for that?
I'm afraid we're out of time. McKay Jenkins is Cornelius A. Tillman, Professor of English and Director of Journalism at the University of Delaware. His new book is called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. McKay, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.